Thank you ever so much, Jim. How's everybody this morning? Wonderful. Sure, everybody, let's have a good time. There's nothing serious about this deal. This is the prescription that saved their lives. Hell, we ought to be happy with it, folks. Really, hell, ain't nothing to it. I know we can start. The War Department just walked in. She's the cause of my drinking. She's sitting right down here. I'm ready to go. You know, no one has ever seen Alcoholics Anonymous. You can't place your finger on it. Each member is a mirror or a reflection of how our 12 steps work. When we looked in the mirror while we were drinking and saw a shallow and empty life, we did not want anyone to know us in that condition. We lost our self-respect, so we lost all. Through these wonderful 12 steps, we found a happy way of life without the use of alcohol. And Burl didn't tell you that I am a drunk. My name is Icky. Through trying to follow the program of Alcoholics Anonymous with the help of God and a group of people like yourself, I've not had a drink of any kind of alcoholic beverage or goofballs in any kind. In 2 days and 6 months and 14 years, by the grace of God and nothing that I have ever done or ever will be able to do. So I owe my life to you through this wonderful 12 steps. We're going to try to run this thing today so we can get out of here. There's going to be some wonderful talks right after lunch. And I know many people here want to hear it. So we're going to cooperate. We're going to have a wonderful program. And I know that you're in store for a rich experience when you hear what these people have to say about our 12 steps. To me, this is the way I feel about it. I tried to find where my soul might be. I looked to God and He eluded me. I searched my fellow drunkard out and found all three through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Our first speaker this morning is a man from the far north country. He's a publisher, Ed W. He's a publisher of the wonderful little red book that so many of us enjoy and read. A friend of mine tells a story about Ed. These two drunks went to a funeral in Minnesota. And as they was walking out after the services through the graveyard, they saw a sign over a tombstone, and it says, "Here lies an honest publisher." The other drunk turned to him, and he says, "You know, that is the first time that I have ever seen two people buried in the same grave. I give you an honest publisher from Minnesota, Ed."
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't know about this honesty. Greetings, fellow members of AA. As you know, I'm not here to discuss humility, but I can assure you that I feel very humble at this time. Very happy to be here, however, for I consider it a real privilege to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and to participate in this meeting today. Step one is my subject. My remarks will be confined to the working mechanics of this step, as I understand it, particularly how the thing worked for me, and with emphasis upon my physical allergy as a contributing factor to my alcoholism. If I should go enthusiastic, get out of bounds a little bit, please remember that any enthusiasm I have will spring from the life that I owe AA and the hope that I may be of service to this fellowship. It is obvious that the daily use of a poison as potent as alcohol must often seriously injure the body of the alcoholic. It was true in my case, at any rate, and I believe that physical illness had much to do with my powerlessness over alcohol. For it wasn't until this physical energy left me and I was knocked down that I would make any honest effort to stop drinking. And I found my formula for happy, contented sobriety, and I underlined both words, in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And it still is my only authority for recovery from alcoholism. I put my faith in that book. I study that book quite frequently. And as I study it, I've learned certain things. And the first thing that I bump into is the statement that the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. And that any picture which leaves out this physical factor is incomplete. Now, this seems to me to be logical. For an AA, what do? We treat first things first. And it is the physical illness that usually drives the alcoholic into AA, and it supplies him with that initial humility to make him admit that he is hit bottom. The humility to admit that he is powerless over alcohol, and the humility to admit that his life has become unmanageable. Now, I tried to stop drinking by every device known to any alcoholic, but nothing seemed to work for me. Nothing except an attempt at suicide. It came the closest to my solving my problem. In fact, it damn near killed me. Finally, desperate, broke, and sick unto death, I called AA for help, and that was on December the 13th, 1941. And I am duly thankful to God and to AA that in spite of many close calls, that I haven't taken a drink since. Well, sir, help came to me quickly, within the hour, and it came in the form of a very strange, weird-appearing individual. He was no ordinary-looking alcoholic, I can assure you that. He stood about 5'8" in height. He weighed about 230 pounds. And he was dressed in a grease-stained overall jumper. He wore a 2 days' growth of beard, and he sported an awesome handlebar mustache that came up on the ends with points. And as he walked around my dying bed, grunting and panting, he was twirling those things. I guess I looked as bad to him as he did to me. Later, in AA, I learned that Evie brought faith and hope to Bill, but to me, this guy brought nothing but visions of AA as a hairy, bewhiskered cult, which I thought it was. My sponsor, however, had redeeming features, and there were two of them right then. One of them, he was sober, and the other one, he was happy. And he also did something else. He cleared up this mystery of my compulsion to drink during a hangover, which nobody could understand. He explained to me that my urge to drink at that time was physical, and it was due to an anemic condition, a dehydrated condition of my body that had run my blood sugar down lower than a gnat's eyebrow, he told me. And he suggested hospitalization to repair this damage. He promised that my jitters and my foggy mental condition would clear up as soon as I got into the hospital, and then it would allow me to study and practice this AA program. Well, I wasn't interested in study. You can imagine, I was darn near dead. But I did want to end this physical suffering, and I wanted to end it bad. So I went along with this guy, reasoning along the way as well as I could reason, that it would be much better for me to grow whiskers in AA and be sober than to remain in the condition that I was in. Well, we laugh at it now, but it is an important matter. Later in AA, you'll learn how important it was that to take care of the physical body. I've seen many members who neglect this. They pay no attention to it. They can slip back, get drunk, and then wonder what in the heck is the matter with them. About now, some of you are probably saying to yourself, well, hold on there, mister. Step one concerns more than the physical illness of alcoholism. It definitely involves the psychological aspects of this illness as well. A lot of this I will heartily agree, but I also agree with Dr. Silkworth's advice to Bill when, after 6 months of failure to dry up drunks, he reminded Bill of Professor William James' observation that truly transforming spiritual experiences are nearly always founded upon calamity, desperation, and collapse. That was me. Stop preaching at them, he told Bill. Give them the hard medical facts. This will soften them up until they will do anything to get well. Now, I understand that was the way Bill, Dr. Bob, handled Bill Dodson, the number three member in AA. They gave him the hard medical facts. And they gave him darn good medical help as well. They really gave him the works. It worked on him. It's a good system. It still works, and I think we should work it more frequently. From my own experience of 30 years or more of drinking, I can reduce down to its simplest equations the physical illness of alcoholism that made my life unmanageable. I gotta have it simple. I couldn't take it any other way. I drank, but I didn't eat. Over many years, I progressively substituted alcohol for food, for vitamins, for minerals, and for other bodybuilding nutrition. And I missed a lot of relaxation and sleep. See, I regarded alcohol as a beverage, but I was using it as an anesthetic until I developed a case of chronic alcoholic poisoning. It's that simple to me. And this condition, along with my dietary deficiencies, subjected me to nervous tension, to irritability, to the jitters, and to a general instability of personality. The irony of this was that to calm my jittery nerves, I had to drink, and that by drinking, I only aggravated the allergy that made me jitter. There's no mystery about alcoholism in my case. For many years, I worked 24 hours a day to acquire it. Now I'm doing just the opposite, working 24 hours a day to arrest it. I accept these simple facts as plausible reasons for my powerlessness over alcohol and my unmanageable life. And this makes me open-minded, willing to accept step one without reservation. In fact, it was all that my befogged mind could assimilate when I came into AA, and usually as much as the newcomer's mind can assimilate when he comes in. It was all that I needed at that time. It served as a sort of springboard, an AA springboard, from which I could ascend to higher levels of AA understanding. It brought me the courage to face an incurable malady. It provided me the incentive to treat my physical illness, and it gave me the faith that by living the 12 steps that I could arrest it. It gave me a true realization of my inadequacy to deal with the many complexities of recovery from alcoholism. It supplied the humility I needed to accept help from my higher power to arrest my mental illness, which is the next step in this program. Thank you.
Our next speaker is an Okie. And he's not a great speaker, I want you to know. A lot of Okies here. Old George Hale from Oklahoma City, and I want to tell you about the first time I ever heard about George. They built a new jail in Oklahoma City, and they made arrangements at the ice house, if anybody should get drunk, to actually put them in the cooler. George was a Saturday night town drunk. They threw him in the cooler, and that evening the sheriff went home about 9:30 listening to the radio, not television. Listening to the radio, he told his wife, he says, old George is in that ice house. He rushed back down to the ice house, opened the door. Way over in the corner of this ice house, all crunched over in the corner, was old George. He looked up and he says, close that door, I'm freezing to death. George from Oklahoma.
Hi, everybody. My name is George, and I'm from Oklahoma City. And 8 years ago, the fourth day of November, I had my last drink of alcohol. I learned something this morning that I didn't know, but I operated for 18 years unconscious, and I'm not surprised at any trick that I would pull. Because we in Oklahoma, when we drank 24 hours a day, and we worked hard at it. It was the hardest job that I ever tried to do in my life. I'm supposed to talk on the second step. We came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. This was strictly foreign to me when I came into AA. The only thing that I knew about faith or God was, or my soul was, it was part of my sheep. I did know that the ministers referred to it as your soul, and the psychiatrist as your personality. But in AA, I found or discovered, I like to believe, that self that I had to live with. And even though this faith was not yet understandable to me, when I came to AA that first night, I could look around and see many men and women who were from 1 year to several years old in AA, and who told me that they hadn't had a drink in 1 day or 12 years. And I had no right to not believe that, because I had really been living on simple faith these 18 years that I had stayed drunk. Something had kept me alive so that I could fall through that back door of that AA clubhouse. And thank God these people were waiting there to take over this body of mine. And that's all that I could present. Restore me to sanity. To me, this means bring me back to normalcy. Remove from me those fears, those resentments, that hate. And above all, take me away from that first drink. That would restore me to sanity. Keep me from reaching for that first drink, because that's when I become insane. Is when I, before I take the drink, not after. I become a drunk then. I'll do anything. When I reach and before I take that first drink, I become insane. So I ask for the faith and the power to keep me from taking that first drink. Because this drunken self that I had lived with had taken me on an 18-year drunken journey. He had stole from me that part of my life which I was rightfully entitled to. He had embarrassed me in the eyes of my friends. He had taken me from one job to another. And it was very hard for me to forgive this self that I lived with. Now I can do that because of that faith. And because I have been restored to sanity, and because I do not operate in a world of fear and hate and resentments, I can forgive this self for this terrible thing that he did. Because he now prods me on to attend AA meetings and improve. And the only way that I can improve in this faith and in this sanity is by attending AA meetings. And I don't believe that any alcoholic, be he young or be he old, be he drink 1 year or 20 years. It's my opinion. Before he can live with himself, he's got to come to believe that a power greater than him can restore him to sanity. You know, I have to live with myself and so. I want to be fit for myself to know. I don't want to stand in the setting sun and hate myself for the things I've done. I never can hide myself from me. I see what others may never see. And I know what others may never know. So whatever happens, I want to be self-respecting and conscience-free. And the only way that I can do that is through the second step, is come to believe and have faith in my fellow man. And these 12 steps, and take it as a way of life, without any questions asked. I drank, and I didn't question the quality or the quantity of the whiskey. And it took me literally to the grave. Why should I question this AA way of life? And folks, my last remark is, remember, If there wasn't any God, there wouldn't be any AA. Thank you.
Thank you ever so much, George. I just loved his remarks. And the first word came. A lady helped me so greatly in that step. She says, "Icky, you have to come to first." It took me a long time to come to, I'm telling you. Joe, can you hear way back there? You know, I was scared to do that. I did that one time in a meeting about like this, and I says, "Can you hear in the back?" And this old boy said, "No." Joker sitting on the front row says, "Wait a minute, I want to change places with you." We came out here on train, and I stopped everywhere in Arizona finding out about this next speaker, and everybody knows her, but I couldn't find out anything. And just as we got into Yuma there, well, there was an old Mexican there sitting squatted down with a sombrero. It was just 112. And I went up to him, and I thought, sure, that somebody would know this beautiful lady. And so I asked him, he says, "I sure do." I said, "Do you know anything about her before she was in AA?" I said, I know about them afterwards. I said, "Do you know anything about them before?" And he says, "I sure do." Said that she was the most confused person you'd ever know, that she didn't have a patio to pace in. Don't try to talk to me if you're tongue-tied.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Monica B., and I am an alcoholic. And I am a member of the All States Participation Group in Phoenix, Arizona. It is indeed a tremendous privilege and one of the great highlights of my life to be with you here this morning sharing our experiences. I am particularly grateful to be in this part of the country here in Southern California because it was 10 years ago, almost to the date, that some of you in this room came to me while I was in a private sanitarium in Los Angeles and shared your courage, hope, and strength with me. I attended a few meetings at that time, and I agreed with these 12 steps in a general way, but it was impossible for me to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. I thought it was up to me to run my life. I was not agnostic, nor was I atheist. I just simply felt that I was the one that knew best for me. Now, I was perfectly willing to have God assist me in the pinches, but that was as far as it would go. 5 years ago, you people were celebrating your 20th anniversary in St. Louis, and I had come to this point in my life. I thought just perhaps if I would admit that I was alcoholic, associate with alcoholics, that would do the trick. And so I promptly joined a facility of AA, a club in Phoenix, Arizona, by the name of the Arid Club. I admitted to the people in the club that I was an alcoholic, and with that I played bridge and gin rummy like mad for 9 months. Now, I don't have to tell you what happened. The element did happen, another drunk. At this time, two very good friends of my husband and myself came to us and asked us if we would care to go to the convention in St. Louis. And it seems just like yesterday that this is what I replied to Howard and Eileen. "You mean me go all the way to St. Louis to be with a bunch of drunks? Make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God." This third step, call it a spiritual exercise, is very closely woven for me with the B part of this program, that no human power could relieve my alcoholism. So it had to come to pass for me, and I think this is true of all alcoholics, that we do by the trial and error method exhaust the B part of this program. No human power can relieve the alcoholism. It became a medical problem to me, so I could follow the medical profession. I had their solution. I think he said goofballs. I'm a goofball addict, too. The result of that, failure. I decided that it was a psychological problem, so I attempted psychiatric field. Result, disaster. My will, my way. At this time in my life, I had the rare and great privilege of working with an alcoholic priest, a member of Alcoholics Anonymous in Glendale, California. And he said to me, Monica, until you go to AA and obtain and maintain your sobriety, you not only will not be sober, you won't even have your church. My will, my way. It then became my family. If only my family would do what I wanted them to do. People, places, situations, and things became an obsession with me. And it was my ego image that was running riot. All the natural things came to pass for me. Hospitals, sanitariums, a state institution here in California, jails, and then the geographical cure into Phoenix, Arizona. Somehow, some way, it was dawning on me that this life that I was running, this life run from self, was a complete flop and had ended in disaster. And through the grace of God, in a woman's 12-step house in Phoenix, Arizona, on September the 28th, 1955, the gift of decision was given to me. God gives many wonderful gifts, but he gave me the gift of decision. Decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. I had absolutely nothing to do with this. I did not then, nor shall I ever take any credit for it. It was a direct gift. And it happened something like this. I seem to have found myself in a state of complete and utter despair, a sort of a surrender. And for the first time, I said to myself, I have failed. And then there seemed to come a willingness. And I said, God, if it is your will for me to stay drunk, give me the courage. And if it is your will for me to take me now, give me the strength. And if it is your will for me to find a new way of life, give me the faith. And God gave me the greatest gift of all, the gift of faith. First, the gift of decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. And then this tremendous gift of faith. God gives us many, many gifts, but the greatest of all his gifts is faith. And it is the only gift that God gives us that in order to keep it, we must give it away. Christ said, where two or three are gathered together, there am I in your midst. And St. Paul followed, bear one another's burdens. This is how AA works. Faith in God, faith in ourselves, and then faith in our fellow man. In the last 5 years of this peaceful way of life that I've had, I've many times thought of one of the characters on T.S. Eliot's plays, where he said, I have almost lost touch with the person that I thought I was. But in closing, I would like to share with you a letter that was written to me by my mother on my 4th birthday last year. And in it, it will tell you so clearly what did happen to me and how it came to pass that I was able to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. Well, my dear, that special time is here again when I seem inclined to write my intimate thoughts to you. For it is as you are now that makes for me a certain contentment and a green spot in a sometimes drab existence in my life. I have likened your progress to the Stations of the Cross. I don't know how to exactly explain this, but I have at times, when I have made visits to the church and sat in silent meditation, and looking at the stations, I seem to think of you as you were attempting to make the grade towards sobriety, and how you faltered and fell so often, and then by God-given strength and the great AA program, you finally carried your cross of alcoholism to emerge from those clouded years to celebrate a fourth birthday. Life is the sort of edifice we choose to build for ourselves, Monica. And I know long ago you tried to build this edifice for yourself and for others. For you wanted to reach goals for yourself and others, but you wanted to change others to fit your pattern of life. And when this became a difficult thing, you started the downward road into alcoholism. And on you went until you reached your own rock bottom. And it seemed as if all hope of ever returning back was gone. But there was the silver lining. When you finally accepted AA with its great principles, a guidance to your future, and by this adjustment, by instilled faith of prayer and hope, a complete surrender, going ahead in spite of great heartbreak you had to make, for you had lost so much and had gone so far. But you learned the things that are not easy, to begin over, to keep trying, to make the best of life with its problems. They are always there, you know. And now as I close, I especially ask as you start another year that the giver of all gifts take particular care of you. For I also say that all that is, all that was, all that ever shall be is part of God's plan. May God bless you and keep you.
Ever so much, Monica. You know, we think we're helping you, but some of us jokers have been here this long. We haven't ever taken all these steps, and I know it's going to do some of these speakers lots of good, because right before we started, one of them come up and said, Icky, what is steps going to? So we got newcomers up here. This old boy from Montana, he's got one that I wouldn't touch with a $100 bill for many times. If he can take that fourth one in 8 minutes, he's a better man than I am. Take me 80 years and I'd never make it. He sobered up out there in one of them dried out clinics in Montana. And oh, he was hungover. And he asked this old doctor that was running this place. He says, Doc, he says, how come I keep going around in circles? Doc says, shut up or I'll nail your other foot to the floor. Right?
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning, Mike.
Thanks for coming out to listen to me talk. I know that you're going to enjoy some of the speakers who are going to follow me the same as you have enjoyed the three who preceded me. All joking aside, when I received the invitation from Hazel in New York to be a speaker here this morning, it pleased me a great deal. And it is my earnest hope here that with the help of the good Lord, maybe I can leave some thoughts with you people which will be provocative at least, and maybe in some small measure help all of us to work the AA program a little better. On the program, it said Miles Key from Helena. That is correct. However, most people who know me as Mike Key. Needless to say, I'm an alcoholic. If I wasn't, I wouldn't be here. And the fact that I'm meeting all of you wonderful people makes me just happy as all get out that I am a member of this wonderful fellowship. And although I'm an alcoholic, I'm disgusted with a lot of the things that took place during my drinking career. And for that reason, I'm not going to discuss any of you good people by a recital of those things. Rather, I'm going to take a minute, and I'm not on the State Chamber of Commerce either. I'll tell you a little bit about Montana. We call ourselves the Treasure State, and we used to lay claim to being the third largest state in the Union. That was when Icky State could lay claim to being the second or first largest state in the Union. Since the advent of Alaska, of course, and its admission to the United States, Icky has had to take a back seat. And that reminds me about a story I heard about a soldier from Rhode Island who was stationed in Alaska. And one of the natives up there was asking him if he wasn't enthralled about the size of that wonderful new state. And this kid replied, well, he guessed it was all right, but if all the ice ever melted up there, it wouldn't be any bigger than Rhode Island. Now, I know that statistics don't prove anything. I'm reminded of a professor I had in a course in public speaking one time in college. He called on me unexpectedly to give a 10-minute extemporaneous talk. Fortunately, I had read an article the night before in Newsweek or something and contained a lot of figures, and I had just stood up and watched my watch and quoted figures at random. He said, "Mr. Thomas, what are those figures you are quoting?" And I said, "Why, Professor, those are statistics." And he said, "I want you to remember this and all the rest of you students, too. There are lies, damn lies, and statistics." But regardless of that, we do have in Montana what the State Board of Health estimates to be about 18,000 alcoholics out of a total state population of 666,000. And AA has about 500 or 600 of these in 30-odd groups that we have scattered throughout the state. My particular town of Helena, we have a population of about 25,000. And we have 50 good working AA members in our group, so that it's hard to tell just exactly what the AA population would be in Helena or in Montana. But I know that there's a lot of room for other people to find out, as some of us who have found out, and that is that they can have a lot more fun being sober on the AA program than they can have by being drunk. Now, Hazel asked me to speak for a few minutes on step number 4, which Icky wouldn't know, and I'll read it to him, is made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Now, believe me, this is a tough step to discuss, and probably because it's one of the most difficult ones to take. And incidentally, you'll all understand that the views which I express here this morning are my own and do not necessarily express the views of the AA program. And after approximately 13 years on this program, I'm not sure that I have completely taken this fourth step myself. The word in the step that has been a stickler to me is that word moral. I think maybe it's been a stickler to others. Does it mean right or wrong? Does it mean good or bad? Does it require action? Or is thinking sufficient? Or does it require the keeping of the Ten Commandments? Just what is the meaning of moral? Maybe I can illustrate this point by a story. An old couple lived across the street from a cemetery, and they were sitting out on the porch rocking back and forth. And the old lady said, "Pa, you know, sometimes it makes me sick. Thinking about Arnell laying over there in that there cemetery." And the old man spoke up and he said, "Ma, I think I know what you mean. I wonder sometimes if she wouldn't be better off dead." There you have it. Is that an immoral story? Is it a suggestive story? Or is it just an ordinary beatnik story? If it is an immoral story, whose mind made it immoral? Mine or yours? Maybe some of the confusion arises out of the definition that we give to this one word, moral, when we start taking our inventories. Now, Funk and Wagnall's Standard Dictionary gives this definition: conform to right conduct, especially in sex relations. Well, maybe that's a good inventory to take, but I just wonder. I just wonder if maybe if that's all the meaning that there was to the word, whether some of us would ever get the step taken. And I wonder if we wouldn't run away from AA rather than take it. But fortunately, that same edition of the dictionary, what's that sounding me off?
Yep.
Gives a lot of other definitions. Dutiful, ethical, excellent, faithful, good, honest, honorable, incorruptible, religious, upright, virtuous, worthy. Now, when we start using some of these other definitions, it makes it a little bit easier. A lot of our actions are probably worthy. And when we start taking our inventory, we'll find it a little easier to take. I said our inventory, not the other fellow's inventory. That's a lot more fun to take, the other fellow's inventory. Like the fellow went to church and he left, and afterwards they said, "Why'd you leave?" And he said, "Well, during the first part there, when that preacher was telling about the others, he said, that was good preaching. Then he said he got to meddling. He started talking about me." I think maybe the co-founders had a different idea than just the one definition for the word moral, because as we come along in the later step 10, as we continue to take personal inventory, we want to remember that reputation is what we know, is what the other fella thinks we are. Character is what we ourselves know we are. Now, since this light has gone on, I'm going to be like the old lady who, after she had, the lady who, after she had given birth to her 10th child, was asked, "What are you going to call it?" She said, "I'm going to call it quits."
We got a little system up here. When they talk 7 minutes, they put the white on, and they're all colored blind. I never saw such a bunch of people. The next friend here this morning we're going to hear from is from Oregon. I think he's going to talk to us about the basic foundation of Alcoholics Anonymous. If any of you haven't taken the fifth step, do so, please. I'm awfully happy to tell you that I humbly believe that God removed the compulsion to me to drink. When I admitted to God and another person the exact nature of my wrong, it's the most serious thought in my mind that I'll ever have, and I thank you and I thank God for the fifth step. And I know that Lib has been freed from the compulsion to drink alcohol to this step. Lib?
Well, I'm Lib from Oregon. An alcoholic. Well, there's one thing that Icky did. He assured you people that this afternoon you'd hear some good speakers, and that was real nice of him, because I'm not too anxious to hear what I've got to say. I'm kind of like the little boy that messed his pants. I just haven't got much to say. But I can't, in the first place, I'm no authority on anything. I'm not an authority on any particular step. I'm not an authority on any tradition or any other phase of Alcoholics Anonymous. The only thing that I know and know for sure is what I have experienced. And I can read the big book. I think we're all in pretty much of agreement as to the purpose of this fifth step. But how we go about it is pretty much up to us. I can't take much credit for any fifth step work that I've done because it came automatic for me. I was in Alcoholics Anonymous 9 months before I could stay sober 3 weeks. So this thing didn't come easy for me. I didn't go into Alcoholics Anonymous because I was noble and I wanted to quit drinking for me. I came in because I was hounded by lawyers and cops and my wife, and being sued for a divorce, and just got out of the state nut house, and a few of those things, and through an outside man, there seemed the possibility of regaining my family, and so in pure desperation, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I walked into that first meeting, I didn't know what I was going to. I assumed I was going to some sort of a meeting, but I find that I'd walked into a new way of life. Now, let me tell you just a minute how I got sober. Now, in this Alcoholics Anonymous I'd been in there, I could not stay sober. I could get sober, but I couldn't stay sober. But to show you how things will store back in our minds and we're not aware of it. Finally, after 9 months, I'm right on that final 21st day. And I came home from work nervous as a cat. Through this minister, my wife and I were living together, and I was in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had to make it. I had to make it, or if I hadn't, I wouldn't be here. I know that. But I was desperate. And you know how we get when we get churned up? God, you run into the kitchen, you get a drink of water, and you pace the floor, and you go back and get another drink of water, and that's the way I was. Powerless to keep from taking a drink at that particular moment. As powerless as I have ever been in my life. So I told my wife I was going for a walk. She knew where I was going. I could tell by the expression in her eyes that she knew where I was going. I only lived 2.5 blocks from the liquor store, and I never did live very far from the liquor store. But I started down that street, and something flashed through my mind that a man had repeated in AA that he had heard somebody by the name of Tom from Portland had said that the time will come when you're completely powerless to keep from taking a drink. And if you can't do anything else, pray all the way to the liquor store, and even if you buy the bottle, keep on praying. And you know, it just began to come out, just as simple as ABC, please God don't let me take this drink. Now I think there was a difference. In previous times, I didn't want that drink. I didn't want to take that drink. Well, sir, I lived on 6th Street, and the liquor store was between 3rd and 4th. I lived between 6th and 7th. And I started down this side of the street, kept repeating that and repeating it. I remember crossing the street on 4th, or on 5th, and went on down and crossed the intersection to 4th, and there's that liquor store right down. And that's the last damn thing I remember. That was the one good blackout that I had during my life, and I give God absolutely the credit for all of it, because when I came to, I was sitting up on the Methodist church, the top steps, completely at peace with the world, for the first time in my life. Now, I didn't hold that sobriety. I had a lot to learn in this thing, but believe you me, something wonderful happened. And during the next few months, I'd been sober about 2 months, and I needed some more. And I needed to know I needed to know that my children knew that I wasn't drinking. Oh, I'd promised them and told them and then come home drunk, you know. And so my wife, like Bill's wife, was working in that damn department store. And I went by the nursery and picked up my little daughter. She was 4 years old then. And as we were going down the street to get my wife, we passed the Methodist church. And she attended Sunday school in the Methodist church. And she says, "Daddy, there's my Sunday school. And you don't drink anymore, do you?" And I had asked God to have those kids show me. So there was proof, and a wonderful feeling came over me. Something I can't describe. But it filled up faith. It gave me more hope. More strength to go on. And so I got pretty brave with this God business. And from then on, a minister was the man that steered me toward Alcoholics Anonymous. His name was Cuffy. I think he was the only minister in the world that I would have had anything to do with. But he was a ball player and I was a ball player. And so we had something in common. I admired him. I didn't know him, but I liked him. I liked his looks. And so I wanted to talk to him. I wanted to talk to him, and I hadn't had a day off in about 10 months. That's how steady that Weyerhaeuser Timber Company goes. But a funny thing happened, you know. It seems like that when we get sober and we're sincere and we're really sincere in this thing, if somebody gets in front of us with a broom and kind of sweeps the road as we go along. And that's what was happening to me. And this particular morning, I went to work, and lo and behold, the night before, I hear I want to talk to this guy. I got some things I want to tell him. And I'll be damned if the switch engine, the night before, didn't jump the tracks and piled up all the boxcars. And that was the first time in months that I had had a day off, and so I took the day off. Now, I didn't go home. I jumped in the car, and I drove back and forth in front of this Parsons. And it was about 7 o'clock in the morning. And I wanted to go in, but there wasn't any smoke coming out of the chimney. So finally I went downtown, I got a cup of coffee, and I came back by, and I see the smoke, and I looked up and knocked on the door. And he came to the door with a mouthful of eggs, and he says, come on in. So we went in his kitchen, I went in, and he flapped a couple more eggs in the pan, and he poured out a cup of coffee, and we started visiting. And all of a sudden it just poured out of me. Fifth step. I didn't know there was a fifth step in the book when I cleaned up with him. So I can't take any credit for this damn thing. The fifth step for me is hard now. It wasn't hard then. It's hard now. And when Hazel wrote me and asked me if I would speak on this fifth step, I don't know what the hell that thing is.
You got mad at me.
Why, a minute and a half?
Half.
Huh?
Half a minute.
Oh, Jesus. Anyway, it just poured out. We'll see how time can pass to that. Anyway, let me get down to just this one thing. I have to simplify things. If I can't see it, I can't work. And I love to fish. And anyone that's fished in this Northwest knows that you run into drift, especially in that McKenzie River. It's a fast stream. And I love to fish, and I heard he this isn't my idea either. I heard this in the sermon one time. And he was telling these church members they better clean them too. You know, that's just a hospital for the sick. And so he was comparing it with a log jam, and he was telling about these big trees that the bank caves in, and they fall across the river, and they wedge in between a couple of rocks, and then all this debris gathers in behind. And to me, it made sense. Because I had a key log back in there, it was giving me hell, and that was the thing I didn't want to talk about. It was easy to tell the people about the things they already knew about me, but not this one. It was too touchy. And so up to this day, I've tried to keep that in mind. That there's a key log that gathers all this stuff, and until we get rid of that key log, by God, we're not going to feel clean inside. We're not going to be friends with ourselves, and it's pretty hard to get in this feeling of belonging, not only to Alcoholics Anonymous, but in a good relationship with God. And so all I can say today is that I've done the best I can do. I've got a lot of work to do yet. I don't think you ever complete the fifth step because, by God, there's a tenth step that says you've got to admit these things when you do wrong, and I've done wrong since I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm not so humble that I always admit them in hell. If you let them lay in there for 2 or 3 years, you've got another fifth step yet. So every once in a while, I speak for myself only, I got to get that damn log out of there again so it can go on down the river. But it's the happiest step in the program, and thanks for listening.
Thank you very much, Liv. Our next speaker this morning is really from the largest state in the Union, regardless of what anybody tells you. We had a cocktail party for non-alcoholics. We used up enough ice at one drinking session, they don't even can't find the last cup there anymore. But we really are happy to have this beautiful lady with us today. And I know that Ethel will leave something that you'll always remember in regard to the sixth step. Ethel?
Thank you, Icky. I am Ethel from Texas. Hi. And Mike was telling his reaction when he got his letter from Hazel. Well, I'll tell you, mine was entirely different to mine. I went into that alcoholic thinking, and I thought, what in the hell is Hazel trying to do to me? I got to looking so stressful. I've been a member of Alcoholics Anonymous in good standing for over 9 years, and I thought I knew the steps, and I thought I'd taken all of them. And I got to looking at that sixth step, and I'll tell you, I just started to just wire Hazel and say, get somebody else. That thing, I don't know. And it tells you in the book, in Bill's interpretation of the 12 steps, that the sixth step is the one that separates the men from the boys. And I'm telling you, for sure, it does. I studied the interpretation of that step. It also caused me to go over the interpretation of the others. So I finally came to the conclusion, we heard it, we all know that God works in devious ways, his wonders to perform. I needed to know about that step. I needed very much to know about it. I know, and have known all the time, that I had so many defects of character. Have always had and always will have. And that is the thing that throws me on this sixth step. Of course, we are supposed to work this 24 hours a day, the remainder of our lives, if we expect to stay sober. We don't have to take it as the remainder of our lives, just 24 hours at a time. But I know from the 9 years sobriety that I've had, in the association with members of Alcoholics Anonymous throughout the whole United States, that it takes constant vigilance on everything for me to stay sober. I know that. And I know that God has removed the desire for a drink. I know that. But I had more trouble with one other thing than I did with not drinking, and that was learning, through the help of God, to control this horrible temper. Well, thank God, I still got it, and I don't ever think I don't let it loose once in a while. But it's just once in a while. It's not every 15 minutes like it used to be. So I know God is helping me to control that temper. And I think, next to my, well, the couple with alcoholism, it was the worst thing about me. I know that. Temper and alcoholism caused me to be a perfect Mount Vesuvius, and nobody ever knew when she's going to erupt. And when she did, it was a booger. And thank God, through this program and the help of God, I have learned to control my alcoholism, the desire for a drink, and this temper. And the other things, which are many, I think the thing now, this is my opinion, is we have to be willing to try. I think willingness is a key word to the whole program. We've got to listen to other people. We've got to take the inventory that our previous speaker was talking to us about. And in taking that inventory, you're going to find those defects. And we've got to work on them constantly. But the thing, I haven't even quoted the step yet. It scares me. We're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Well, there are three words in there. If you haven't thought about them, they'll scare you. We're entirely ready. Those first two words. When I found this program, it was handed to me literally on a silver platter. I loved what I'd found. I'd been searching for years. As you can look at me and tell, I'm no baby. And I had drunk for many, many years, and I've only been in AA 9 years. When I found this, there's a man sitting out there, was the first man I heard speak. I didn't know the first thing about Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew it was something keeping some of my friends sober, but I'd never been to a meeting, and I was tricked into a meeting, thank God. And I liked what I found. I accepted it wholeheartedly. I did not question one thing. I still do not question one thing about this program, one word that's in it, except I want to know what entirely ready means. Now, those are the two words I want to know, and I want to know if somebody can help me find out if I'll ever be entirely ready to have all these defects of character removed. I think if I'd get entirely ready, I think God in his own wisdom would remove them. I don't think it would come a clean slate all in 1 minute. I think shock would be too great, and I might not survive it. But we can trust God. He does it, and he doesn't do it just like we want to bargain with him for it. And I found out another thing since I've been in here. God's no slopper. No, sir. I tried that. I tried it for a long, long time. But you, God's no slopper. He will do what he thinks is best for us. And evidently, the drinking of alcohol and that temper are the two things that God felt that was most important for me to be rid of. I think maybe I've been suffering from a little self-righteousness. I told Icky yesterday, I said, I had two resentments. He said, only two? And I said, well, they're two just like thorns. And I've been fighting now for quite some time, and I think I've been trying to tell God how to get rid of them. So I have, in the last few days on this trip, I drove out with two friends of mine, and I think on this trip I have finally decided that I'm going to let God handle it his own way. And I think when we know what our defects of character are and turn it over to God in his own way and in his own wisdom, we'll get rid of them.
Thanks, Jefferson.
Thank you.
I'd like to mention at this time, and I'd like to say a big hello to all the ladies that are here, because they seem to be in the big majority. It used to be one of my pet things to watch as far as the literature that was produced by the head office was concerned, was the two pamphlets, The Alcoholic Wife and The Alcoholic Husband. And amazingly enough, the pamphlet for The Alcoholic Husband was outselling the one about The Alcoholic Wife 2-1. So it shows you how interested our wives are in our progress. But there's an old saying, you know, that behind every good man, there's twice as good a woman. She either gives them a push or a kick. As you probably know, I'm Scotch by my accent, but by absorption, I come from Canada. Canada brought me here many, many years ago, and I hail from Victoria, British Columbia. I'm not a member of the Chamber of Commerce there, but I want to put a plug in for Victoria, because it's one of the quaint little English towns that sits at the bottom of Vancouver Island, right on the tip facing the Olympics, which are in the United States. This little part of Canada is one of the nicest spots you could ever visit. And if you ever get an opportunity to travel away from home, it's not too far distant from here, and you'll find you'll get a wonderful reception, and you'll find a lot of friendliness and a lot of good hospitality. When I got this letter from Hazel suggesting that I might talk on step 7, which incidentally, we have covered half the program now, so everybody should be at least half sober. Whether we're going to remain sober the other half or not will depend entirely how we take this step. Because step 7 is one of the most potent steps that we can ever take. We may have taken the 4th step, but until we have taken the 7th step, we will never remain sober. 7 is lucky for a lot of us. Drunks as we are, I hope it's the luckiest number we'll always have. But to be humble and humbly ask Him to remove our shortcomings. These shortcomings, you know, are something that I don't think we had anything to do with. As far as our character defects are concerned, we had a lot to do with them. Because we've nurtured them ever since we began to live by ourselves in this world. But our shortcomings are something that come to us unconsciously because we never think too much of the other fellow. I read a good definition of that in your local newspaper. It said that shortcomings were something that were practiced by relatives by staying too long. Or I got it mixed up anyway. By too long staying, that's what it is. However, these shortcomings are something that we can only analyze and sift out for ourselves. You see, this program is a very personal one. It's one that has all to do with me, nobody else. Sickie said, or somebody else said here, it's easy enough to take the other fellow's inventory, but it's pretty damn hard for it to take our own. And when we begin to criticize ourselves for our shortcomings, then is the time when we begin to stand up and be counted once more. Because these shortcomings of ours, and only mine, I can't take any consideration for yours. These are the ones that bug us all the time, these little shortcomings. We have to also take into consideration that if we have by this time found some power greater than ourselves, after all we have been sober for a little while, then we have to take that same power into our confidence and discuss those same shortcomings that we are guilty of. Because we know that to get along with our fellow man and also continue to get along with ourselves, these are the things that we have to take care of very, very quickly. Because my experience in living has always been that I could never get along with myself. I could get along with other people very well. But to myself, there were always some things that just didn't suit me. And I can remember when I was drinking, in the morning, that was one thing that didn't suit me, was when I looked in the glass, when it came necessary for me to shave. That was the most horrible thing I had to do in the morning. And so consequently, it was an easy matter for me to look for a hair of the dog that bit me. Because I wanted to get away from myself completely, and that was the only way I knew how. This program here has taught me many, many things, as it has taught you. Because it's only since we got this program that we've managed to learn something about ourselves. You know, this question of having to be stand up and be counted again is something that we can all take unto ourselves. Because too often are we trying to give a double answer to everything that comes along. One that we don't like, and one that suits us very well. That's how we all become a dual personality, because we're afraid to face the truth. The truth is the one thing that we're willing to turn our back on at any time. But the face that we show up to the public and other people is the face that we always want to put foremost. And so consequently, this question of our shortcomings is something that only comes to us when we're in very, very close meditation with ourselves. Because I know many, many things about me that you don't know. And you shall never learn from me. Because I am going to keep those innermost in my heart to myself, and I'll probably die with them. But any of them that are bugging me, any of them that are going to upset me any time, I'm definitely not going to be against sharing them with someone else. And that is another thing that this program has taught me. It's the sharing of those burdens that I carry with someone else. Just the same way as someone else that have burdens will share them with me. And in that way, we manage to communicate this program to one another so that we are able to live with it. You see, we were people who didn't have too much to live with or by. All we were trying to do was pour ourselves into a bottle. And we found that that wouldn't work and didn't give us too much happiness out of life. And so, in adopting this new life, we have to be most careful about these little things that we know about and nobody else does. And these are the things that I think are thought of when it comes to the seventh step. And they're the one things that we have to be careful about. We have to be continually thinking about them. We have to be so careful sometimes that we don't want to be caught and get found out. And you know, that's a tremendous thing for each one of us to carry on our conscience. I presume you have certain shortcomings too, same as I. But thank God we have an organization such as this, and we have so many friends that we can ask for that help. It says, to humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. And the only person I know is God that you could ask. And you can only do that by yourself, because he's your God, not mine. Thanks very much.
Thank you ever so much, Mark. The eighth step will be discussed by a man who I've known in AA for a long time. And before the meeting, we were talking about the eighth step. And Charlie says it's not time enough for him to ever list all the people that he's harmed. So he's just going to make amends, and I'd like to give you Charlie.
Thank you, Icky. My name is Charlie A. from Montgomery, Alabama. I had a letter from Hazel a week or 10 days ago, and it started off, "Dear Charlie, we are delighted that you have accepted our invitation to speak on the recovery program on the eighth step." Well, that was the first I'd heard of it. And I guess the reason Hazel put it that way is because I never have done anything about the eighth step. And if the committee was looking for somebody who was less qualified than I, they would have had to go a long way. I feel, though, that I should explain my position about this eighth step. After 26 years of pretty hard, at least constant, habitual, almost everyday drinking, I had made such a hell of a mess of friends, family, people, that everybody had just charged me off. Nobody gave a damn. And when I came to the eighth step and decided to make a list, there really wasn't anybody to list. My wife had gone, married again, had another family. My parents were dead. I had no kin folks. All of my friends, I picked out some of them and went to see them, and they didn't seem to give a damn about any apology. So I just didn't get any wife. I would like simply to state that the eighth step, I believe, is probably just as important as the first or the second or the third or any of the rest. And if we are here to advise us and ourselves, I would suggest that you try the eighth step. I just didn't have any luck with it because I couldn't get anybody to take it.
audience could have seen your faces. I said, you us bunch of phonies, you all just looked through us and y'all were right with Charlie. Yes, he was right with Charlie. You know we sober up in spite of Alcoholics Anonymous. But the senator from Washington is going to tell you about it. Now there's no ifs, ands about it. Senator, come on up here. I want to give you Senator Barr.